Hello and welcome to Turtle Tracks Podcast. This is your host, Brian Van Hooker, and I'm here today with the director of the first Ninja Turtles film, Steve Barron.
Hey, hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Yeah, good.
So I wanted to start out by saying this, and I'm 32 years old, so I've kind of been a fan of Turtles my entire life, and I've never been out of it. So like I've been a fan of every single type of medium of it, and I say this without equal. I think your film is, to me, the definitive Turtles in the way I see them.
Oh, thank you. That's well, I mean, I suppose we had an advantage, really, because we were first, so in a way, everything else is a variation on it, I suppose.
True. I'm a fan of the original Mirage comics, and it's close to that, but it has the right amount of humor blended in, where it's that it's the drama carries, but also a good amount of comedy. So I it's to me just the perfect balance as to what to me the turtle should be.
Well, that's great to hear. Thank you. Yeah, it was really. I feel the same way when I watch films. Is I just want the kind of I want it as grounded as possible. I want to believe it and have it not sort of take the Mickey out of itself, is what we say over here, I think, and be true to itself. So it is, you know, very very real, grounded, and centered in some believable reality, even if it's an extraordinary idea.
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, the focus on like keeping it really grounded and on earth and really like, you know, yes, you're talking to giant mutated turtles, but that's really the only thing you have to suspend your disbelief for. Everything else kind of feels like, I know it's mostly North Carolina, but it feels like New York. It feels real. Even the crime wave, you know, ninjas in New York in the 20th century sometimes comes off as silly, but the fact that it was blended in with the children was very clever. So like there's so much of it that was really felt like connected to our world.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's that was what I was all for. That's why I really didn't want to, in the first film, put in the other far out characters. Really, I thought you got these Ninja Turtles and this giant rat as their father, and I think everyone else needed for me to be human. You didn't want to get into Bebop and Rocksteady and all these other extraordinary characters, because then I think it's you don't get time to really absorb and connect them to your world.
And it makes the Turtles and Splinter less special in that way.
Yeah, exactly. I think they were definitely enough to play with in a 90-minute movie to really explore them, and because it's so radical from what you've been exposed to before.
Yeah. Now, I just saw, where did the movie start? So, like who was the first, like, when did the idea of a Ninja Turtles film begin?
It really began, I think, with Golden Harvest in Hong Kong, who had seen the comic book and were becoming aware that a toy company was interested in taking them on, and that this was a really interesting idea. They do a ton of, or they did then, a ton of action films that were involved martial arts, so they were always on the lookout. They wanted to move into America and, you know, move as a company and start doing productions that were reaching an American audience and were still connected with Kung Fu. Karate Kid was obviously massive, and there was so they were really on the search. So they were kind of fairly obvious choice for that, and they were going to do it as a in their style. Maybe even we talked about doing it in Hong Kong, actually, first off, when I was approached.
Oh wow, would have been a very different film.
Yeah, it would have been. I mean, I think it would have had all the character and everything that we were aiming for, but it would have felt quite. It would have had a different feeling. But not necessarily a bad one. I think it could have worked. But I think, you know, we'd have lost our little you know, three or four liner characters that we were able to cast out of New York with really good people, you know, Sam Rockwell, you know, obviously if we'd have shot it in Hong Kong, I don't think I'd have been able to use a casting from out of New York for those smaller characters. It just would have been too expensive.
True. So who was the first on after that? Was it Bobby Herbeck? When did you come into the mix?
Yeah, Bobby Herbeck was the first person I approached because I think Tom Gray knew Bobby, and he said, "Will you write a script?" And they did a first draft, and they sort of sent me that first draft, and then after they sent me some comic books, and then I came in from there, and then worked with Bobby to try and get it a little closer. It was nowhere near a shooting script. It just didn't have the dramatic pull through that you need for a good film. Engagement and the comedy all needed to come into it, and it was a start. And you know, often movies go through 130 drafts or whatever, but you know, this was draft one, and so it was quite a bit off. And Bobby flew over to London to work with me for a few months, and we got it a little bit closer, but I felt it still needed to gain some sort of smart humor and a slightly stronger, more contemporary spirit. And we came across the writer Todd Langan, who was doing Wonder Years at the time and was really, really good television writer. So we got him in to do a draft, and I worked with him for a number of months, this time in LA, started really developing. I mean, we didn't really have the money yet, hadn't raised the money for the film yet, because they hadn't got a script they could send out. And but we had little bits of drip, you know, meeting money sort of. So I met with I obviously knew Jim Henson from earlier, from TV series earlier, and I met with him and told him about the project, and he was worried about the violence in it, and but in the end, you know, I kind of promised him, even though I was leaning, by this time I think the first animated series had come out, I said, I was doing it more based on the comic books, where there was a level of reality to some of the violence. There was sort of repercussions on it, and so he just ended up, he's lovely, Jim, and he just ended up trusting and said, "Well, I'll trust you. We'll do it. I'll trust you to keep the tone of it and the spirit of it, not to get into the mean area and not to encourage anything that was not ethical or moral."
Now, talking about Jim Henson, so I know that you'd met him when you worked on Storyteller, correct?
Yes.
And so what was working with Jim Henson like? I'm a huge, huge fan, obviously, you know.
He was a beautiful human being and very special person. It's got a bit shocking at first, because he actually talks like Kermit the Frog, and so when I met him first, it was like chatting to Kermit, and that was pretty much his voice. And then just a gentle soul, really sweet, very creative. For him it was all about characters and their relationships with each other, and that was fantastic, because that was spread right into the development of the creatures and the way they were made, and it was special. It was really a very special relationship, and I'll always treasure it.
There's some sort of feeling that, like, he was not happy with the violence in it. Do you have any idea what he felt about the final product? Or did he live to see it, now that I think about it?
Yeah, he did.
Okay.
he wasn't. I can't remember the exact timing of, but yeah, he totally lived there. I showed it to him.
Okay.
And he sat down and he said, "This is really cool." He really loved it. And in fact, I showed it to him because I was still not happy with it and felt that we didn't have enough time because there wasn't enough budget to do everything we wanted to do. And I felt there were holes in it. And sweetly, Jim said, "Well, talk to my friend Jeffrey Katzenberg, who's running Disney." And I said, "Well, you know, I think we just sold it to this new company, New Line." And he said, "Well, you should talk to Disney, because then you could get everything you wanted in terms of everything else you want to shoot, to fill in the holes and things." And so he set up a meeting for me to show it to Jeffrey Katzenberg, which is a long story, but it was he really liked it. He was very pleased with the tone of it, the spirit of it.
I'm glad to hear that, because there seems to be some sort of like feeling that he wasn't happy with the violence, and certainly given who he is, it makes sense that he would be averse to it. But like, I've heard you talk about how it's sort of in that swashbuckling Three Musketeers type vein, and I think it is still in that sense of fun and adventure, and it's not hyper violent in a way that's...
Now, he was the only doubts he had was at the very beginning, was before we made it.
Oh, great.
And that, yeah, so that no, that's not true. That he loved, from the moment he saw it, he was very happy with it and very happy with the work that his Creature Shop had done on it, and really happy he'd made it. Yeah, he was delighted.
Now, speaking of the Creature Shop, who came into the picture first, you or he or them?
I was there first. I brought them in.
Okay.
Because I'd worked with on the Storyteller. So, it was really, I convinced Jim to allow us to work with the Creature Shop on it.
Now, I'm curious. So I once attended a screening of the movie with, I think it was Martin Robinson, who operated Leo's Head. And he explained a bit of the process, how, like, you know, there's somebody in the suit, there's somebody afar controlling the head's expressions, who are doing the face, and then obviously there's a voice actor that was added later for most of them. But can you explain a little bit of that process? Because it sounds, I don't completely grasp it, and it sounded a little bit chaotic.
Yeah, it was pretty chaotic on the set. You'd get the actor inside the suit, and then you'd get the puppeteer who was working the facial movements and the sync. And the dialogue from off camera, and the two of them would have to be very in sync, because, you know, the slightest movement from the person inside the suit would have to coordinate with the speech and reaction and you know, everything from the mouth and the eyes and the eyebrows and the smile, and everything would have to, that would all have to be in sync. So these guys worked for some months together. They rehearsed every day and got their movements very close, so that. But what the puppeteers needed to do to be able to puppeteer is say the lines as well. So you'd get, and it only made sense for the guys, the actors inside the suits, to also say the lines, so their expressions would come through their bodies. And so you've got two lots of people talking at the same time and saying one line of dialogue. And, you know, it's not absolutely insane. So it's like hearing a lot of people talking, and especially when they were, you know, talking at and with each other, the four of them, you've got eight voices kind of yabbering away. It's like kind of chaotic.
With everybody except for Raphael, it was that the intention from the start, is to recast the roles later?
Yes. Well, no, it wasn't. I always felt that there was probably some voices that would be stronger performance-wise later, except for Raphael. I thought Josh Pace was a really prominent young actor from New York, and he'd never done suit work, whereas Leaf and a couple of the guys, David, had been inside performance puppetry suits before. Josh was just a really good actor, and I really wanted to push that character, Raphael, to have a really strong actor inside the suit, as opposed to a strong performer or a strong experienced suit performer. So Josh was first choice for that, and I always wanted to use him as the voice. But yeah, later on, I think Golden Harvest really was wanted a bit more pizzazz, a bit more well-known voices for the other characters and things, and they were going to be. It did make sense to redo them anyway.
No, I know my favorite turtle's always been Donatello, and I particularly like Donatello in this film because it feels like, you know, he's still the smart turtle, but it wasn't in a way that was like he's not going to build a spaceship or some crazy gadgets. It was portrayed, his intelligence was portrayed through humor, which I really liked.
Yes. Donatello, eh? So you were a purple kid.
Yes. Yeah. Still am.
Okay.
Do you have a favorite turtle yourself? That was on my list of questions here.
I like Raphael because I'm quite grumpy as well. So I liked his character because it was he was fighting internally with himself, and that sort of made it really interesting. And I liked his whole relationship with Casey Jones, and that scene with when he first meets Casey as well is one of my favorites, I think.
Oh yeah, and Rip pretty much straight from the comics for the most part, which was great.
Yeah.
Now, yeah. I'm curious about when the story development was happening. I feel like, you know, when you have a comic book or a cartoon, you know, you can have an episode about Leo and Mike, and you can separate them out. But with a movie, I feel like everybody's got not equal time, but, like, it needs to be distributed a little bit more evenly and have everybody covered. And I feel like your film does that in a way some of the other ones later on didn't. And was there a conscious thought about we want to make sure everybody has their equal, not equal, but, like, given time?
Not really. No, it was about. I mean, I really liked some of the comic books, so I just the story really came together by I kind of tore pages out of the graphic novel and stuck them, pinned them on a wall, and put them all in a slightly different order, and then there was our development person at the time brought to my attention a little article from a newspaper thing. It was a Philadelphia newspaper about a Fagin character who had all these kids stealing for him in Philly, and it felt like the missing link, basically, because I couldn't quite find from the comics what the Foot were up to and what the Shredder was up to and how it connected to teenage. And it wasn't quite connecting as well as it did when we brought in this idea of the Fagin role.
Yeah, it helps kind of like implant it in this city, in New York City, really.
Yeah, totally.
I always felt though, like the way the characters were distributed was really like, you know, like Raph and Leo kind of carry the weight, the drama of the role, whereas Mike and Donnie kind of carry the comedy and are kind of like a little commentary on the drama of the film.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Yeah, Todd did a great job on it, actually. Good writing.
Going back to the Creature Shop a little bit, I'm curious, like, what are your feelings on, like, how that artwork has changed now with CGI kind of replacing it for the most part? It feels like a lost art.
Yeah, it's a shame, really, because it is exciting when you can get something lit in a room and it's a creature and you know you sit there and you start believing what's going on and the movement of it and everything. And I think there's still room for films with that technology and CGI. There's definitely room for films with CGI. I mean, I felt when Lord of the Rings came out, and I saw Gollum, I thought, yeah, this, you know, now is a new time, and this is amazing. This is a character that I have the same goosebumps about when I see a great animatronic character. And that's the first time in CGI I'd felt that. And so I think it can be done in CGI, but it can look amazing and be amazing. It's just really all about the animators or the puppeteers or whoever's steering the ship. That's what either works or doesn't with the CGI.
I'm noticing some kind of, like, it's a little bit of a reaction to maybe too much CGI. Some team be heading back. Like, I think the new Star Wars had some, and I heard you talk about Where the Wild Things Are, and it's a nice blend of those two things.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's possible to marry them, and, you know, with the right project, I think it's good. It's good too. It's too easy now to just say, you know, every page, just say that there's the character and we'll do it in post.
You can feel it. Like, I feel like you just, like, there's a physical difference.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. Yeah. I think you're right.
Now, I was curious. So, I'm curious. The first film turned out to be such a huge success. Was there any sort of approach to you, or was there any sort of interest in you doing a sequel back when this was the time?
Yeah, actually, I had a contractual right to do the sequel, actually.
Oh.
The only thing is, there was a little bit of a strained relationship with the financier, with Golden Harvest, to be honest, who obviously did an amazing job doing a film. But I wanted to do this extra shooting and fill in some of the gaps of things we didn't get time to shoot. I mean, because we made it for $7 million, and we shot it in 7 weeks, and the, you know, the half of the budget went for the creatures, and half of the time for the shooting went to the creatures. So we were very strapped, and I felt there were a number of loose areas within the film that just needed a bit more to them, and we fell out over that, and. We fell out kind of over the fact that they thought it was too dark. They thought I'd made it too dark, and it was just kids would be frightened, and it wouldn't work, and parents wouldn't bring them. And so, having fallen out, and obviously we sort of made up when it came out, it was a big hit. Everyone was happy, but I just felt like I'd then done it, and I thought, to do a sequel, it wouldn't do much, and I think they were still talking about making it more colourful and brighter and stuff, and so I just thought, well, I'd done it, and what was the point in doing a sequel?
And they ultimately did make it more colourful and brighter and all those things.
Yeah.
The sequel.
Yeah.
Do you remember any story ideas or anything that you thought maybe this will be in the sequel?
I'm sure we worked on stuff, but I can't remember, to be honest.
So what were some of those, like, those loose ends that you talked about? The what were some things that you felt like needed still doing that ultimately didn't happen?
You know what, I think it was the crime wave and what was going on around Shredder that kind of ended up coming, basically pages that we didn't have time to shoot. But there was probably 12, 15 pages of the original script that we never got to shoot. Now, I didn't need to do every one of them, but some of them, by just being told, we got no more time, can't shoot anymore, there's no eighth week, so you've got to just cut it together and make it work how it is and do it with voiceover or whatever. And that, for me, you know, weakened it. And I can't remember what the scenes were, but there were, you know, a number of them, and who knows? But we never got to make it. But you know, in the end, people seem to like the movie, and even though it's not kind of probably as good as I think it could have been, I'm still very proud of it.
So, how do you feel it holds up? I know you've talked about having seen it after so many years, a couple times.
Yeah, I feel it holds up. It's quite fun. I watched it with Kevin Eastman in New York at a special kind of, this must have been about 8-9 years ago, but it was some sort of anniversary screening outdoors, and I looked at it with a lot of fans, and we sat and watched it, and I hadn't seen it for 15 years or something, and it does hold up. I enjoyed it.
Was that on the West Side Highway?
I think so, yeah.
Because I was there, actually. I was living in Brooklyn at the time, and I went to that screening, and it was great.
Yeah, great. Yeah. It was cool.
I think there was a turtle van there, and I think somebody from the... Yeah, I remember that, actually.
Yeah.
So I think that really covers everything. I really want to thank you for your time and your contribution to Turtle history. And, is there anything else you'd like to say about the movie? And
No, I think we covered it, really. I think that's all. That all sounds good. That was interesting thoughts that you had. And, thanks for that. And good luck.
Thank you so much, Steve. I appreciate it.
All right.
All right, so this has been Brian Van Hooker with director Steve Barron for the Turtle Tracks podcast. Special thanks to the guys over at Turtle Flakes who we're doing this podcast in conjunction with. And thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, everybody.
Take
care.
Thanks,
Brian.
Time to wait. We need help right quick on the double. Have pity on the city. Man, it's in trouble.